Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 66 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the novelist Fiona Shaw tells Frances Burns of how she felt an affinity with her PhD subject, the poet Elizabeth Bishop, but never anticipated being a writer herself, until severe emotions forced something out of her.
"I've always wanted to write something special" is a line that shines out of Fiona Shaw's first book, Out of Me, a memoir. It's about her postnatal depression. Since that memoir, she's written four novels: The Sweetest Thing, The Picture She Took, Tell It to the Bees, and A Stone's Throw. Simple titles for fictions that explore how we complicate our lives and obscure our loves. Fiona, what did writing something special mean to you when you were growing up?
I think that quotation that you used came from being taught by a particular English teacher for whom I had to write stories and essays. It was when I first went to secondary school, so I was about 11 or 12. She was rather beautiful as well, and she was, I suspect, not that long out of university. She had this amazing long black, long dark hair, and I think probably half the class were enamoured of her and wanted to impress her, and I was certainly one of that half. My stories always came back with a kind of B brackets plus, which translated to me as sort of middling, and I had this longing to write a better story, probably for her. But I went away one weekend and I had this idea for a story, and it came, I thought, from a memory. What I remembered was, we lived in London, and we must have been on our way home somewhere, and it was after dark. And what I remembered was being driven past a fire. I remembered the family stood on the pavement and a small child in a nightie. And I remembered, as I think lots of other writers are often caught by, was the memory of seeing the inside of a house when you shouldn't see the inside of a house. So I wrote one story about that, and that got her, got her attention. But I didn't really have a sense of myself as a writer then at all, or even as somebody who wanted to be a writer. I was a passionate reader from a very young age, like many writers, but I wasn't like many writers, somebody who was doing a kind of Bronte sister scribbling away at all.
If you look back at yourself, can you see a picture of yourself reading in a certain way and a certain place?
Corners. I used to always read in corners. There was a particular windowsill I did love for reading, but it was in my grandparents' house, which was a very old cob-walled cottage in South Devon. Cob being mud and straw, and so the walls are a metre thick, but it meant that because the walls were a metre thick, the windowsills were very deep. And there was a particular windowsill in the kitchen that you could just, particularly if you were not fully grown, you could sit up on, and you could look out onto the cottage was at the end of an estuary on a quay, so you could look out at the water. So it was a pretty blissful place to read, but I'd say a bit public, because obviously it was in the kitchen, so lots of people coming and going. I used to have the piss taken out of me when I was a little bit older, because I always, and still pretty much always, have a book with me. So we'd go on a journey sitting in the front of the car and somebody else would be filling up for petrol and I'd get my book out, or in the supermarket queue get my book out. And again later on, as an adult with kids walking them to school, I always would read on the way back. So I suppose yes, I was corners would be what I would say.
So that's very interesting. So you did a PhD on Elizabeth Bishop. Mm-hmm. And I had imagined that you were working towards being a writer the whole time. Mm. But even at that point, you weren't imagining that writing is what you would do.
No, I wasn't.
And does she help on that journey?
I don't think she does help on that journey. I loved writing about her, and I love her poems. She attends to the physical world beautifully, plainly, and with very, very telling images. I think she gives a lot of room for you as a reader to imagine what's going on elsewhere for the figures that she puts into her poems. So, for example, well, actually, there's a very haunting poem which I think I quoted in my memoir out of me called Sestina, which is about a grandmother and a small child in a kitchen. And what they're doing is looking through an almanac, and the child is drawing pictures. But it's clear, even though it's not spelled out. I think that's what I like about it. And in this poem, it's clear but not spelled out that there's some terrible sadness alive in that kitchen for that grandmother and that child. But the poem is beautiful, so although it's sad, you don't finish the poem feeling depressed or bleak, because she's made this beautiful object out of it. And her most famous poem, one of her two most famous poems, is called One Art, which is a villanelle, and it's short, and it's about loss again. The loss of objects and the loss of people, the loss of a continent for her. She spent the middle of her life in Brazil and then had to leave. The loss of the woman she most loved, or the lover that she most loved. So she describes these tremendous losses, but she writes these very beautiful poems that both contain the loss but don't fully describe it.
In your memoir, Out of Me, you say, Bishop wrote to defend herself from intolerable pain.
Mm-hmm.
Did that resonate with you?
It did resonate with me powerfully when I was writing the memoir, yes. What I was understanding by then, but what I hadn't understood about myself earlier when I was writing a PhD on Elizabeth Bishop, was how strongly I identified with that in Bishop's work for myself.
Out of Me is the title of your memoir. It's about your postnatal depression. It describes depression so deep, it really banjaxes you. You're sectioned with your new baby, really devastated.
Devastated.
Devastated. Mm. The book reminds me of a religious testimonial's not the right word. I'm going to ask you the right word. When people come to the front at a church and say, this is my story.
I began writing it when Jessie, my baby, was a year and a half old. And I finished the first draft of it about a year later. So the writing of the book happened while I was still, certainly still depressed, and B, then I was coming out of the depression, but still very close to the experience. And when I reread the book, what I'm struck by after all these years later is how fierce the book is. And sometimes by how few jokes there are, which, I mean, you might say it's not a subject for jokes, but everything is a subject for jokes. There aren't any jokes in that memoir. And I think if I had written it later, it probably would have had other qualities that it doesn't have. But what it wouldn't have was that quality that you're trying to capture, which is this confessional testament quality, which it does have. There's an imperative need to tell it.
And what was it you needed to tell?
Well, one of the things that I really needed to try to write down was the experience of being depressed almost beyond language. And so there I was trying to use language to describe what often rendered me completely inarticulate. Or either I couldn't find the words, or I found that I was using words endlessly and I couldn't stop. But it means you can't do what Elizabeth Bishop did in her poems, which is to create something that will hold the feelings. You can't get a containment on them. So perhaps one of the efforts in writing it at that time for me was to try to articulate and contain something. Not to say that I had exhaustively described it, but that I did describe it in such a way that I felt it held the feelings that I'd experienced. So that was one of the things I wanted to do. The other thing was that I became very aware very fast, not in the first few months after Jessie's birth, because I was way too depressed and I was hospitalised and I didn't see anybody. But in the year afterwards, I became very aware just how difficult a subject it was to acknowledge for myself, to other people, having been depressed after my baby was born, and how common an experience that was, that I didn't meet one woman while I was researching the book, and I was looking for other people who'd had some kind of experience like mine. I didn't meet one woman who didn't feel guilty. And there was nothing that I could find written about it. There were a couple of self-help books back then. But there was nobody doing what I wanted to do, but also what I wanted to read, which was saying, this is what it feels like for me. So that there was an imperative need to write for that reason as well. And then the third thing that came in as soon as I started writing was to think, well, why on earth did it happen? It wasn't until I really started writing that I recognised. I was also seeing a psychotherapist, and the two began almost at the same time, seeing a psychotherapist and then beginning to write. But it was only then that I began to think, well, what's just happened to me, age 27, 28, has a connection with my experience of my life earlier. And I hadn't really thought that before. I was aware that it had something to do with my dad's death, and he died when I was 20, because I was so preoccupied by it. But I hadn't really stopped to think about the other things that I had done in relation to the depression before then.
Do you feel like you've written out of grief?
Perhaps. Yeah. Mm. I think probably not in my father's death, not simply in my father's death, but in my relationship with my father and the person that he was. It was a very difficult father to have. I loved him and he died when I was 20, so I was barely an adult. I hadn't seen him since I was 17 either, so he died really before I was an adult. So I never had the opportunity to develop an adult relationship with him and process my child feelings of longing and wish for a closer connection and fury with him, which was very hard to acknowledge, especially when he then went and died, that he was so unreliable, so drastically unreliable, and not just with me. I mean, he was like that with his wives, with his lovers, of which there seemed to be many. So, yeah, I've lost track of the question now, so I'll have to stop.
I was thinking about it in terms of drama as well, that if you're writing a play, whoever's working on your script always wants to know what your characters want. When somebody's depressed, that they can't identify wants at all.
Or if they can, they're always beyond reach. Yeah.
Okay.
I knew what I can still remember this experience in the psychiatric hospital of wanting, longing to be mothered. I have a mother. I still have a very beloved mother. But so it wasn't that I wanted her to be there and mother me. It was that I wanted some other kind of something that I could only describe as being mothered. Nobody could do that. She couldn't do that. My husband couldn't do that. The nurses certainly couldn't do that. Even the really wonderful psychiatric nurses, because it was an impossible need, an endless need, that I didn't know how to manage or contain or understand.
So you had a driving need. It is, you talked about how difficult it is to just transform depression when you're in the depression and writing about it. Can you talk about how you do find ways to convey the depression?
It was very, really hard. I had to come as close as I could to the feeling. When I had a first draft of the book, sent the manuscript to an agent that somebody had recommended to me. She said, I don't think this book is ready for publication at all, and I'm happy, but I'd be happy to meet you and we can talk about whether I'd represent you. And one of the things she said in that lunch meeting, I can still remember we went to a Greek restaurant somewhere in Bayswater. One of the things she said to me was, take out the I remembers. I remember this, I remember that. She said, it's distancing. It distances the reader. She said, take them out if you can bear to. And so I did, but it wasn't a simple act. It wasn't simply going through and finding every sentence that began, I remember. It meant that I actually had to reformulate the sentences. And she was absolutely right, but she was also right that it would be hard, because what made it difficult was that it took me very close to the experience. Yeah. The other thing she said to me was, as the first draft was, she said, we're into a kind of full-on psychological breakdown within about 2 pages. This is too quick. You know, you need to give the reader more of a sense of a life lived and of a life that you want and that's desired and that you think you're happy in. So can you go away and do that, please? So I went away and wrote more about my life before my second child was born, my life with Hugh, my husband then, and with our child and our holidays, going to Ireland, working on my PhD, that sort of thing. So there was a longer preamble before the birth of my second child and this terrible depression which happened so soon after it. But it still wasn't an opening. And I thought, well, what do I want to do for the opening? And I could hear Hugh and a friend in the garden with the kids thinking, I know what I need to do. I need to describe this cottage, the cottage that we've made and live in. But perhaps I should describe it as though it was somebody else coming into it who didn't know us. And what would they see and what would they imagine? What would their fantasy be or their idea be about who lived here? Because in a way, that's what this book is about, or what this book is doing, is it's saying, you thought, or I thought, that this was the life I was living. I was this person in this life, and I am this person in this life, but actually there was something quite other going on that I'm now going to try and write about. It's really, really hard for people to sit in a room with someone who's very depressed, and you are trying to bring the reader into the room with you and make them see things, and it's uncomfortable. I think at some point I describe myself, in the book I describe myself as still having my nose pressed up against it, and I don't have my nose pressed up against it now.
Up against the horror.
Up against the horror, yeah.
Was writing a bit of a punishment as well?
No. Many, many times people have said, was it cathartic to write it? And it wasn't cathartic to write it. It was necessary and really helpful, but it didn't actually take me through and out the other side at all. No. But I forget my memory. I keep forgetting your question.
Ask about your memory.
Yeah, yes, do ask me about my memory.
So,
Because
you've described how, like, the trauma and the treatment have made you fearful about your memory.
Yeah,
you
feel.
How much is writing to do with making sure you don't forget things?
Good question. I don't think I quite know how to answer the question. I've been worried by my memory ever since. Not by the effect of depression, because that definitely had an effect on my memory, but it was local. It was local to that time. But the impact of ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, on my memory was very different and very pronounced. And I find memory a very difficult thing to quantify. And everybody thinks they've got a bad memory. What I do know is that before I had ECT, I could memorise poems. After I had ECT, I've never been able to. So what's been really... Recently, I've been rereading Elizabeth Bishop's poems more thoroughly than before, because I'm going to give a conference paper on Elizabeth Bishop in the summer. And it'll be the first time I've revisited her work in that way since I was a student. And what's really interesting to me is how much of those poems lives in my memory. They're there. And I think that's because, well, it's partly because I lived with them for years writing my thesis, but it's also because I learned them before I had ECT. I'm very glad that they're there, because it feels like a rich, rich resource.
Is there any way that it affects the writing, the fear of memory?
Not, it didn't used to. I recent years, and I don't know that this is to do with, I mean, I do think ECT had a really long-term effect on my memory. It's really difficult to pin it, but it's just the change from before to after. And of course, as the time goes on, you think, well, is this to do with ageing? Of course, some of it's to do with ageing. But recently, these last few years, I've really begun to think, I can't make metaphors. And it's a really deep fear in me. And I don't know if that's the case.
The fear might be the thing, not the memory.
It might be the fear. New work that I'm writing at the moment is a young adult, but it's very much got children at the centre of it. I'm trying to write mostly a much faster narrative. So there's not the same... Well, some of it's different kind of writing, because there's not... If I gave way to sort of reflection or sitting in the living in the landscape more, then you think, well, the children have stopped reading, so don't do it. So it'll be, I think, when I start writing something else that I'll get a sense. I almost feel like I want to start writing poems to give myself the room and the time to sit with language and see, and I don't know. So, but it really, really, really perturbs me. Really strange. And you're absolutely right, it may be the fear. It might be fear. It tightens your brain, your mind,
What were the consequences of writing the memoir? For you as a writer?
For me as a writer, the consequences were... The most important consequence of me as a writer was that I decided I wanted to be a writer. But I was also absolutely clear that after having written one memoir, I would be now turning to fiction. Everybody, even if they're writing sci-fi, is drawing on their experience of the world as a writer. But the difference between writing a memoir and writing a novel is that if when it's published somebody says about the memoir, I know this about you because you wrote X, or why did you write this, how does this relate to your life, you have some kind of responsibility to answer that question. If somebody says to me about a novel, did you ever have the experience of, or where did this event that happens in the middle of your novel come from, I can say I made it up. There was a lot of publicity after When Out of Me came out. I think because there had been very little written as first-hand experience about postnatal depression, and quite a lot of interviews, and they were almost exclusively very supportive. But the occasional one that wasn't was horrible, because it didn't feel like they were just talking about a book. People felt they had the license to comment on me as a person. And that was really unpleasant, and so I was very happy to turn away from memoir writing into fiction after that.
But, but, one of the things that really struck me was how accomplished, how this move into fiction, you fathom how to write a novel.
Well, no, actually I didn't know at all. And for the first novel I ever wrote will forever remain unpublished. So the first novel I wrote, and it actually did draw much more closely, not on my experience, but on my family material, because it was inspired by the letters between my grandmother and my grandfather, my father's parents. Both sets of grandparents, as it happens, though they didn't know each other, were in Malta in the 1930s. So the novel I wrote, which will never be published, is partly about a couple. He's in the Navy and his wife is in Malta. And in the novel, I imagine that she doesn't leave Malta when the war breaks out. She stays. Malta was then besieged by the Germans, and they ate rats and leather, and there were more bombs dropped on Malta, which is a total of 16 miles by sort of 5 miles big. It's tiny, than there were on the whole of London throughout the Blitz. I mean, it was absolutely hammered. It was had lots of dramatic material. I didn't know how to write a novel. And when I look at it, I think the dialogue is terrible. It's absolutely clunky as anything. And I never really worked out a good structure for the story that I wanted to tell either. I find the structure of a book quite a complicated thing to work out. In two novels, I've written it by way of a kind of two-handed to-ing and fro-ing between characters. In The Sweetest Thing, there are two central characters, and the chapters alternate from Harriet to Samuel to Harriet to Samuel. What I did really love writing in The Sweetest Thing, and I haven't written again in this way, was writing in the first person, but in a fictional first person. I think The Sweetest Thing opens something like, when I was 16, and so it goes on, and it's in the voice of these two voices, one of a 16-year-old girl who comes to York in the 1860s, and the other of a Quaker gentleman involved in a chocolate factory, which is somewhat like Rowntree's. So I did learn a lot about writing voice then, fictional voice. I mean, I got very kind of tied into knots trying to work out how to get bits of information from one character to another, there's an instance where there's somebody's written a letter that somebody else finds, and then they have to, and I thought, oh no, they found the letter, but it's the other character who needs to know about the letter, and she doesn't read, she's literate, so how am I going to do that? I don't really think that I've learned those things and then they're learned. I think you carry on developing your skills in them.
It's almost having confidence to be the puppet master, isn't it? Just saying, well,
this
happens.
Yeah.
I'm telling you this happens.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I just finished reading Our Mutual Friend. Dickens is Our Mutual Friend. And I loved it. His puppet mastery is supreme in that novel, it seems to me. And I don't imagine I could ever write like that. But, yeah.
I want to talk about endings. I notice with the novels, when you come to fiction, you make things go well.
Yeah, yeah. I find it very, very. I find it very difficult to write. I haven't yet written a bleak ending, and I think I find endings really hard to write. Writing a novel is such a fiction, and one of the fictions you're writing is that you're writing a story that ends on page 324, whatever it is. You're creating these characters, you're setting them in motion, you're exploring, and hopefully your reader with you, exploring what happens to them, and then you're having this fictional idea that it all stops for them on page 324, when actually if you've done your job well enough, their lives are going on, and you'd have to decide the novel's going to stop. So bringing things to a really shaped close seems quite perverse to me. So I think one way around that, of course, is to kill people off. That makes a very dramatic ending. I can't let myself do that. I have a novel set in the 1950s called Tell It to the Bees, which is a love story. The love story happens between two women. And that novel, as with my other novels, ends optimistically, I think it would be safe to say. It's in the process of being adapted for film. It would be great if it happens. We'll have to wait and see. But the first screenwriter, she decided to kill off one of the women. And even worse, the woman committed suicide. And I found that really, really hard to take. A, because it's my book, you know, I didn't want my story that I'd ended in this way to end that way. But actually, politically, I also found it really hard to take, because lesbian stories, the women either die or they're psychopaths. It doesn't look like if it does get made, that will necessarily be the ending now. But I think that's a real challenge in writing fiction. Whereas I didn't feel that about writing the memoir. I did end it at my desk, as I remember. I think at the very end of it, it happens at my desk. But I was able to very much say, this is just where I've got to. Everything's still very provisional. Everything's still very precarious, but I'm just going to stop now.
And can you draw a picture of how you were at the desk?
Well, I remember that. I've always loved my desks. And that desk was in the cottage that we lived in, Hugh and I lived in with the kids until my daughters were 5 and 7. It was a little room with a sloped ceiling, because it was a cottage, and it was an upstairs room in a cottage, and it had a little borrowed light window that looked over the stairs, and a window onto the one onto the garden. I had an old table in there that I'd had ever since university, and it was still my table then. I don't have it anymore. And there was the picture by Picasso of the lovers on one wall, a poster I'd had since I was a student, and I had a kind of montage or a whole range of postcards which I always had. I had always had a lot of annunciations at that point. I had a range of annunciations up the wall. I think I'd loved the formal construction of it, with Gabriel on one side with the lily and Mary often kneeling at prayer. Yeah, and there's often a beautiful architecture, and the colour, those wonderful paints, particularly the kind of Piero period paints. So there were lots of annunciations. There were lots of postcards of various women that I just thought were really striking and I had admired. You know, women who'd done things and achieved things. Writers, but not only writers. There were pictures by my kids, drawings that they'd done and brought me, that were pinned up. And I always had objects on my desk, always stones. I mean, I have bowls of stones which I've collected, usually in Ireland or sometimes in Devon, where I also go from the sea.
That's a really nice picture to go with the image at the beginning of you curling up in corners reading.
Yeah.
Do you still have this yearning to write something special?
Yes. Mm. Yeah. I really want the book to be a beautiful object. And I can't control the cover of my books. I have to bow to my publisher's greater wisdom about what sells. But I do want the text to be as... I would love my writing to achieve what I think Bishop's poems do achieve, which is to be complete, for the book to be complete, but to leave the reader enough room that their imagination can be at work when they're reading with the words that I've given them as a writer.
That was Fiona Shaw in conversation with Frances Burns. You can find out more about Fiona on her website at www.fiona-shaw.com. That's Shaw spelt S-H-A-W. And that concludes episode 66, which was recorded and produced by Frances Burns. Coming up in episode 67, travel writer and filmmaker Hugh Thompson explains how he started out as a travel writer and why Peru has exerted a lifelong fascination. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.